Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you this week from Crested Butte, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. This will be my last episode recording from Colorado for a while as I head off on my big adventure. I'm heading to Bali, Indonesia next week for the Five Freedom Retreat hosted by my friend Amy Minkley. I'll be there for a few weeks, and then I head over to Singapore for a quick stop on my way to Australia and New Zealand, where I will be doing a 32-day cruise with a number of people in the Slacker group that I've mentioned before here on the podcast. So looking forward to that. That's going to be an awesome time. So I'm going to be on the road for about 2 months. I will be recording from the road. And this week, I wanted to answer a listener question about how to calculate your savings rate. But first, I want to talk a little bit about estate planning. I recently had my estate plan revised for a number of reasons, and I do want to preface this with stating that I'm not an attorney, nor do I play one on YouTube or this podcast. This is purely for entertainment and educational purposes only, and I am just sharing my experience that I had recently. I've had an estate plan for many years, and it's always good to review your estate plan anytime there's a significant life event, maybe a marriage, a death, a child that's born, new family members, a divorce, a remarriage, or anything like that. And for me, the trigger was my wife passed away about 3 years ago now, and I thought it was time to update my plan. It still was all fine as it stood, but I just felt like this was an opportunity to just address some items in the original plan that I thought could be better stated. And I also am moving to a new house. I'm still in the same state. And even if I did move across state lines, that wouldn't require me to redo my estate plan. But as a result of selling my house, buying a new house, I did want to clean up my power of attorney to allow for my daughter to conduct transactions on my behalf should the need arise. My wife was the primary agent for me in my durable power of attorney, and my daughter was secondary in my original one, and I wanted to move her up to the primary position and also state who should be behind her. As I was researching a little bit for this episode, I decided to look up, because it was interesting, my daughter actually got hers done as well at the same time. We did use an attorney, and when we were there, the attorney and the paralegal both said, it's really impressive that your daughter is here, and my daughter is 24, because a lot of people her age just don't have a plan. In fact, a lot of people don't have a plan no matter what their age is. So I decided, let me look up and see how many people in the United States actually have an estate plan. And I was shocked to find that, and again, it depends on which survey you look at, but approximately only 25% to 33% of the U.S. population has an estate plan in place. Now, that could partially be because people feel like they only need it if they have a certain amount of assets. And I did see in those surveys that if people's assets exceeded $500,000, that percentage increased to somewhere in the neighborhood of 50%. But that's still pretty low when you think about it. And a lot of people think, oh, this only pertains to when I die and if I have stuff to give away. Otherwise, I don't really need this. And we'll talk a little later about why you might need one of these, even if you are younger, because of unforeseen circumstances. So what is an estate plan and what does it include? Well, there are two approaches to estate plans. There's kind of the simple estate plan, and then there's the slightly more complex estate plan. I went for the more complex one, and we'll talk about why in a moment. But the basic one will include a last will and testament. It will include usually a durable power of attorney. And it will also include healthcare documents such as a living will and a healthcare power of attorney and a HIPAA authorization. And we'll talk about what all these are in a moment. And then the more complex one includes all of those plus a living trust. Now, some people say, do I need a trust? Do I not need a trust? What's the purpose of a trust? here's a couple of reasons to consider a trust. And the primary one probably would be if you own real estate in more than one state. If you do own real estate in more than one state and you do not have a living trust, if you pass away, and let's not even use if, it's when, because everyone will at some point, then your estate would have to go through probate in more than one state. In each state that property was held, for example. And there are some ways around this, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But that's one reason that you might want a living trust. The other is that I recall someone mentioning this to me once before, and they said this: a living trust requires more work on the front end, but less work on the back end for your executor or whoever is settling your estate. And a simple will with the durable power of attorney and healthcare documents requires less work on the front end, but potentially more work on the back end for your executor or whoever will be settling your estate. The living trust acts like you. It uses your social security number. You can move assets in and out of it. You can title assets in the trust. And in fact, if you have a trust, you should be titling your assets in the trust. Otherwise, it's just an empty shell. So for me, I find it beneficial because I kind of like that idea of let me do more work on the front end. So it's easier for whoever needs to take care of my affairs on the back end. So that's why I decided to do a living trust. I also decided to hire an attorney to do it because I want to make sure it's done properly. And if for any reason it needs to be defended in court, that attorney could defend it, or at least it gives me a little bit more confidence that the plan is what it needs to be. Because the challenge is you don't really know if your plan is good until later, potentially after you pass away, and it's challenged. So I like to pay a little bit more upfront, and we'll talk about what it could cost if you hire an attorney versus if you DIY it using online providers. But for me, I felt like it was a worthwhile endeavor. It was also valuable to talk to an attorney and walk through how should I create these documents, what should be in it, what am I missing that I'm not thinking about, and so forth. In a living trust, basically, you will have your assets that you title in there. In my case, it might be my house. And it will also be things like brokerage accounts, savings accounts, and checking accounts, and things like that all can be inside the trust. I am the grantor, meaning that I was the one that donated the assets to the trust. I'm also the trustee, meaning that I make the decisions for the trust. And I'm also the beneficiary. Now, if something were to happen to me, there is a successor trustee. The trust, as it stands, is considered a revocable living trust, which means you can change it. Once you pass away, it becomes irrevocable and it's set in stone. And then the successor trustee will dole out the assets to the stated beneficiaries, which would not be you at that point because you've passed away. So that's kind of how a living trust works. And there's some other documents that you receive: a certification of trust, a trustee's affidavit, which you can then pass on to other organizations without having to send them your entire trust document, for example, when you open an account. Then typically what will accompany a living trust is what's called a pour over will. So effectively, your living trust is kind of like your will already, but anything that is not already in the trust and that is pointed to the estate will basically pour over into the trust via the document, which is the pour over will. So that's kind of how that works. If you don't have a trust, what you will have is a last will and testament. And in there, you will have things such as, and here's why a will is really important for families, for example. It will state who you want to care for your children if you're a single parent, or you and your partner, if you're married or together, pass away, who will watch your children, who will be the guardians of your children. And you can also name a separate or the same person to be the financial custodian for those children. So that's what's really important in a will when you have children. Now, I think we had wills before my daughter was born, but certainly when my daughter was born, we rewrote our will so that we really thought about who would be taking care of her if something happened to both myself and my wife, and also who would be responsible for the financial aspects to pay for our child's costs. And then also it will include things like where do you want your assets to go and all the other things that you would expect to be in a will. So a will and or a trust are extremely valuable to have. And I will talk about a couple of situations where if you don't have those, what can happen along with those documents. So if you get your estate plan created, typically you will have a trust and a pour over will or last will and testament, but then you will also have what's called a durable financial power of attorney, which in essence means that someone else can take care of your affairs if you're unable to. And durable means that it's effective immediately. There's also something called a springing power of attorney where that person or someone would have to prove that you were incapacitated in order for that financial power of attorney to be effective. Or you can also have special powers of attorney if you just want somebody to close a real estate transaction for you. You can just name that transaction and it only works for that one particular transaction. But typically people will have what's called a durable power of attorney, where you will name a trusted person. So you want to really think a lot about who that person is, because literally they can do things on your behalf immediately. And what are those things? So a durable financial power of attorney will include things like buy, sell, and manage personal property, the power to invest and conduct banking, the power to conduct business on your behalf, the power to manage trusts, the power regarding retirement plans and employee benefits, the power over legal proceedings, over government benefits and taxes, and insurance, and also to manage your digital assets, which is now very common for it to be in your durable financial power of attorney. Many years ago, maybe decades ago, that wasn't included. So if you have a durable power of attorney, but it's decades old, you may want to update it to make sure it includes digital assets. So that's a durable financial power of attorney. It includes a lot of powers. So you really want to be careful about who you are selecting to be that agent for you, because that's a lot of power to give someone. And then the other documents that will typically be included in a standard estate plan are the healthcare documents. And typically they will include three documents. One is the healthcare power of attorney. So this is different than the financial power of attorney. This authorizes your healthcare agent, which is spelled out in the healthcare power of attorney, to make medical decisions for you if you cannot communicate. It also authorizes your agent to obtain copies of your medical records, and that's very important with privacy laws today. Then there will also typically be a living will, and it basically will outline how you want to remain on or be taken off of life support. And it sounds like something that, oh God, I don't really want to make that decision right now, but think of it this way. It removes your healthcare agent from having that responsibility to make that decision. In many cases, your healthcare agent may be a related party, and they may not want to have the pressure of making that decision to take you off of life support. But if you've outlined it and said, under these circumstances, I do not want to be on life support, then that removes the challenge for them to make that decision. So think of it as a gift to your healthcare agent to allow them to literally say, this is what they wanted, and I am just following the directions, and now I don't have to worry about, did I make the right decision? So I like to think of it as removing your healthcare agent from that very challenging responsibility. And then the last one is a HIPAA release that will list others besides your healthcare agent if you desire to have access to your medical records. So maybe you want a parent or a child to have that ability, but they're not necessarily your healthcare agent listed in the healthcare power of attorney or the living will. And then sometimes there'll be additional documents like personal property assignments, lists of your personal property, special assignments that you might make for special items that you have, assignment of business interests, for example, or other specific personal property that you want to designate to an individual. And then sometimes these will also include things simply like memorial instructions. How do you want to be buried? Do you want to be cremated? Sometimes that's included in the living will. But usually, if you want something elaborate or a special funeral procession, you can list it in kind of memorial instructions. And those can be updated without necessarily having a notary or what have you, because a lot of these other documents require to be notarized and signed by a witness. So that's also important. A lot of people think, well, I've outlined who I want my stuff to go to in my will. And what they don't realize necessarily, and this can be a good thing or a bad thing, is that beneficiary designations on things like your retirement accounts, on your benefits at work, you may have life insurance through work, you may have a retirement plan at work, you may have an IRA, all of those will have beneficiary designation forms, and that takes precedent over any instructions in a will. So let's say you leave your IRA to your girlfriend that is no longer in the picture, and now you're married, but you never updated that, and you pass away, and you say, oh, but my will says everything goes to my wife. Well, not if the beneficiary designation says it goes to your ex-girlfriend. That account will go to the ex-girlfriend, and yes, it could be challenged in court and all those things, but just remember, beneficiary designations take precedence over any instructions in a will. That also means that you can put special beneficiaries on, and they're usually called payable on death or transfer on death, i.e. POD or TOD, on bank accounts, for example, savings accounts, brokerage accounts, so non-retirement accounts. They effectively act like a beneficiary, but basically what would happen is if you were to pass away and you had a payable on death to your child on your bank account, they could walk in with a death certificate and that account would immediately become theirs. That's what a POD or payable on death or TOD, transfer on death, which are effectively the same thing, they take precedent as well. What are the downsides of not having this in place? There are two recent examples that I can think of. And one was, and I can say I can call her a friend now, Amy, who was on the Choose FI podcast. And it was episode 476. And I will link to that in this episode. And the title is called Love, Loss, and Money, The Shocking Financial Aftermath of a FI, so it's Financial Independence, Spouse's Death. Her husband suffered a freak accident and passed away. And they were married, obviously, but they had separate accounts, and they just assumed that the accounts would go to each other in case of some accident like this. And they were younger, didn't have an estate plan in place, and I will let you go listen to the episode, but long story short is that is not exactly how the money was distributed. There was no beneficiary on his account, and other members of the family did have the ability to claim some of those assets. It's a very eye-opening story of why, at the minimum, you want to make sure those beneficiary designations are in place, and that might have helped with some of it, but also having an estate plan in place. And there's another situation where a very good friend of mine, their nephew, entered a coma as a result of someone crashing through their house in a vehicle, and his daughter actually died in that accident. And as a result of him being in a coma, his wife was unable to do a number of things with his accounts because they did not have a power of attorney in place. So he did not pass away. And thankfully, he's been recovering, and that's such great news. But while he was in the coma, a lot of things could not get done because they did not have a durable power of attorney. And also, you know, it did not come to this, but I can imagine having a living will or the healthcare power of attorney. Now, it was his wife that was there, and usually hospitals will allow a spouse to make those decisions if a healthcare power of attorney is not in place. But it is beneficial to have those documents in case you're single, for example, who's going to make those decisions. So that was another example of not having the documents in place and thinking, I don't need them, there's no reason for it, or I never got around to it. And the other thing to remember, and this kind of goes back to my daughter and the fact that she was getting hers done at the age of 24, and she actually did have some before when she turned 18, and here's why. 18-year-olds are considered adults. When she turned 18, we asked her, and she obliged, to get her estate documents in place, primarily for the durable power of attorney and the healthcare power of attorney, so that if for any reason we needed to conduct business on her behalf or healthcare on her behalf, we would have the documents in place to make those decisions. And as I said, she just redid those recently at the same time I did mine because I had the attorney draw them up for her, or she had the attorney draw them up for her, I should say. It wasn't me. She did the work. They could have them notarized while we were in the office because these documents do require notarization. So how much does all this cost? You might be saying, wow, this sounds pretty expensive. If you do have an attorney draft the documents, it could be in the neighborhood of $1,000 to $2,000 if you do not have a trust, or $3,000 to $5,000 if you decide to go with the trust version. There are online sites that will do this as well. And again, it's important to make sure that you go to a reputable online site if you're going to go the online DIY approach. I have heard places like trustandwill.com. I have no affiliation whatsoever, but I did look up their cost for this episode just to give you an idea of what it would cost. They would charge you, for example, $199 if you're single or $299 if you're a couple for the simple will, power of attorney, healthcare directive, and HIPAA authorization. And they will actually also create a trust for you. So if you wanted a trust in addition, their pricing is $499 for a single or $599 for a couple. Again, I have no affiliation. This is the pricing that I pulled up today as I'm recording this, which is in the middle of October. And so that price could change. And again, I have no affiliation. I'm not suggesting you use them, but I wanted to just give you an idea of what an online service might cost, for example. So where should you start? I would say the bare minimum would be to look at all of your accounts and assign or review your beneficiary designations for those retirement accounts, your payable on death or transfer on death for the non-retirement accounts. And you can also see if your state allows for beneficiary deeds. So Colorado allows you to file a beneficiary deed on your house. So effectively, you're naming a beneficiary for your house. So that would avoid it going through probate. And you can also do the same for other personal property like cars, for example, and I presume boats, RVs, things like that as well. I would consider at minimum, look at those because that's easy to do. You just go into your accounts and see if you have the beneficiary designations already, and if they're what you want them to be. And then the next step would be to consider at least doing an online estate plan. It's pretty reasonable to do. At least you will have those documents in place. It's not terribly costly. And trust me, whoever might have to step into that situation will be very appreciative that you have those documents in place. And then lastly, you consider whether a trust is for you and or if you'd prefer an attorney to draft your documents. It's entirely up to you, but that would be kind of the last stage or the penultimate stage, I guess you would say. Now, let's get to a listener question. So this was an email that was sent in from D, and it states, I've really been enjoying your podcast and digest it weekly, along with a handful of other financial shows. I'm curious how you think about saving percentages. In your last show, episode 31, so I guess that's really two shows ago now, you referenced saving and investing 20% of what you make. Do you think of that 20% as net, i.e. after tax? income, or gross. My wife and I have been targeting saving 20 to 25% of gross pay, inclusive of variable compensation, which, due to our tax bracket, puts us at about 40% plus after-tax savings rate. We live in Northern Virginia. Thanks for your help and what you do for the community. Best, D. There's two schools of thought here. There's the what is your percentage of savings relative to net income, and what is your percentage of savings relative to gross income. I find when people want to inflate their savings rates or feel very good about having a very high savings rate, they will tend to look at their savings rate as a percentage of net income. I personally think that's incorrect. I think it needs to be calculated based on gross income, because net income would remove the deduction for potentially certainly taxes, and also things like 401k contributions. Like, you need to include that as part of the denominator of the calculation, right? So I look at it on the basis of gross. So when I say 20%, I'm thinking of gross. And that was just a number I threw out there as a decent starting point. And I think I've said this before in other podcasts, or certainly other podcasts I've been on. My wife and I were living in New York and New Jersey, and we had very high taxes in those states. And about 30% of our gross income, almost 40% in some years, was going to taxes. So that was a big chunk of our income. And then we were living on about a third of our gross income, and we were saving about a third of our gross income. So I've always said my savings rate has been in the approximately 30% area for most of my life, and that's based on gross. So how do you calculate that? It's funny, because a friend of mine who is actually being interviewed by Business Insider asked me how I calculate savings rates, because she wanted to be very accurate for the article. And so we walked through this and discussed how you calculate your savings rate based on gross income. Okay, so let's talk about how I calculate savings rates based on gross income. So the basic calculation is total savings divided by total gross income. So let's talk about total savings. So that would include things like your contributions to a retirement plan at work. They may be a 401k. And in most cases, that will be outlined in your W-2 in box 12. And there's various codes that you can look up. Usually it's listed on the back of the W-2, the codes. And I know code D, for example, is 401k contributions. But there's also other codes for other types of retirement plans. You might have an employer match, for example. And I include the employer match if I'm vested. And usually you have a vesting schedule at work. In many cases, it's 20% per year. And then after 5 years, you're fully vested. So I include the employer match if I'm vested. And it's your decision. You can decide to include it or not include it. But if you do, take a note of it, because it's also going to be in the denominator. And then you want to think about things like the employee and employer HSA contributions. So that's a form of savings. Any contributions you make to an IRA, whether it be Roth or traditional. Any contributions you make to a brokerage account, for example. And I would net out any distributions. So just your contributions minus any withdrawals that you've taken from that account, for example. And then the same with savings accounts. Any contributions you make, net of any withdrawals or distributions you take from that savings. Add all those up, and that's your total savings. And then gross income. Well, you can look at your W-2 in box one is usually your wages and other compensation net of your 401k tax deductible contributions. But box three includes those 401k contributions that are tax deductible. So that's why it's an easier number to start with. So W-2 box three, plus that employer matching. If you're going to include it in your savings amount, you need to include it in your gross income amount. Same with employer HSA contributions. If you're going to include those in your savings, then include those in your gross income, plus any other income you might have. I would not include investment income in your investment accounts, because that's kind of the fallout of having an investment account. So I would only include other income that might be 1099 income, or it might be rental net income or something to that effect, or self-employment income, things like that. Basically, you add up those total savings divided by the total gross income, and there's your savings rate. So that's how I calculate it. I've always thought of it as a percentage of gross income because taxes are part of that equation. If you're just looking at net income, you're not including a lot of things. You know, you're making that denominator smaller, which makes your savings rate look bigger. So when people say, oh, my savings rate is 90% or 80%, I'm like, that's impossible. Unless you're paying 0% taxes and living on next to nothing. Because, for instance, in my case, when we were living in New York and New Jersey, if I had a savings rate north of 67%, I would effectively be living on zero because taxes were taking up a third of my gross income or more. So that's how I think about it. Well, I look forward to releasing the future episodes from the road. My next stop is Bali, Indonesia. So maybe jump over to YouTube and check that out. I'm hoping to have some pretty cool backdrops. We'll see how it works from a sound perspective. Sometimes you can have a great backdrop, but then the sound's not good because of wind noise or background noise. So that's always a challenge. And there are a whole bunch of really cool people going to that event that hopefully I will be able to have as some fun guests on the show with me. So look forward to that. And I will see you next time, or you will see me next time, from the other side of the world. Until then, have an awesome week. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.